You want to kick it off, Bill?
You do it so much.
Okay. All right. Welcome to our session on Seminole cattle ranching traditions. We have on my immediate left Mr. Willie Johns, who is the outreach coordinator for the Ahtahtiki Museum. Is that correct? Close enough. And then we have his cousin, right?
Right.
Norman Johns, also known as Dad to the guys who work down at Brighton. They both live at the Brighton Reservation down by Lake Okeechobee. And Norman works on the crew there with Alex Johns and the guys.
Yes, sir.
And on my far left and your right, Mr. Bill Mansfield, folklorist with the National Endowment for the Arts. came all the way from Washington, D.C. just to be here.
Well, I'm really here because I've done a lot of research on the cattle ranching tradition and had the good fortune to go on a couple of roundups with Norman here, and he kept looking over and at me and asking when I was going to start having fun. And to tell the truth, I had fun the whole time.
So I think Mr. Willie Johns here is also a independent historian who knows a whole lot about Seminole history in general, and I had the pleasure of hearing him speak down in Gainesville to the USDA just this Wednesday. He's going to give us maybe a 5-minute condensed history of cattle ranching among the Seminoles.
Okay, you know, once you get away from the native population, they call it traditions, but in ours, it's not a tradition, it's a way of life, you know, the cattle industry, the cattle life. And as we heard earlier, that the Seminoles rejuvenated the cattle industry back in the early 1870s after the British had almost totally destroyed it, and after the Spanish had left the herds here, the Cow Creek Seminoles, we heard that came in and took over the herds and dwelled in the areas of the Alachua, or the Alachua County in that area. So we're talking about cowkeeper, Sea Coffee, and the likes. And we even have documentations of trade between the Spanish, and thousands of head of cattle are being shipped to Cuba by way of St. John's River, hides by the thousands, and the quality of beef. And there's letters at the University of Florida that document it, written in Spanish. So that's how we know that. The Seminoles were here, and some historians said that we didn't ride horses, but it's kind of redundant that we wouldn't, because they're horses that were made to ride. And we weren't religious folks, so we didn't think much, you know, there would be a religious barrier for being inhumane riding horses. So we did a lot of horse riding and had large herds in the day. So during the Seminole Wars, if you look at all the military documents, you would have thought that the war was not about Indian removal, but about cattle removal. Because if you count up all the thousands of the hundreds of head of cattle that are confiscated, horses, cattle, and some slaves that are returned back to the owners. So after the wars, after the Seminole Wars, we're pretty much left alone, and we have very little to do with the cattle herd, because some reason, every time we owned cattle, it caused us problems. And now we're on the reservations in the 1920s and the 1930s, and then all of a sudden you see us back to the cattle, the thing that we love so dearly, always, that treated us also bad. Now we're back at it, and it's kind of like history repeating itself, that we would come back to the cattle industry and it would be the survivor of our people. So now, today, with all the history behind us, we are on the two major reservations, the Big Cypress and the Brighton Reservation. And also, we have control of properties in the Miccosukees and other leased lands, and we probably run, I mean, we argue about, Norman and I do, he says around 5,000, but I say about 10,000 head of cattle today in Florida. So as we were becoming cattle owners, we used the USDA a lot and the IFAS programs. And we're like a co-op. We have a lot of different owners, even though the Seminole tribe itself owns major herds themselves and is in the business. But also we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 cattle owners. And if you look at our booth, we have some of the brands that are non-existent today. They're not used, and there's some that are used. And there's a photo with some of the brands, and those are how we identify our cattle with the brand. And also, I'm holding the ear, a cow ear, and we also identify our cattle with the earmarks. And as you can see, I have done a demonstration here, and I took a pocket knife and I cropped the ear. So that would be a crop, right? Those of you that are in the cattle business would know that. And then it's a crop split. So that's a crop split in the cow's ear. Or if you wanted to crop it and make a under square, you would take a knife and cut it this way. Or upper square. Or you would, like my mama's old mark, it would be an upper bit, under bit, under bit, under bit. And then another under bit on the other ear. So those were the ways that we identified our earmarks on our calves. And then also, this is how we identify our hogs. Because, you know, in those days, we used the earmarks on the hogs. And we would have maybe, my mom would have five underbits in one ear and a crop on the other ear or a split or what have you. I started to... In this year here, I started to make it Sharp Sharp. I don't know if any of y'all know who Sharp Sharp is. They're the largest cattle herd in the state of Florida, Lykesboro's. So there's a Sharp Sharp. So when you see Sharp Sharp and the L on the cow, you know that they're crazy. you gotta rope them to get them into the pen. We like I said, we ship our cattle all over the United States, I mean, to the feedlots today. We have improved pastures. We try to improve. We try to get the best grass available, fertilization. We try to lime our pastures and grow the best calf possible. So in the 1920s... We've done vaccination programs. You know, you heard of the brucellosis program? Everybody had to bleed cattle for brucellosis, but a federal agent told us that we should always vaccinate our heifers from 51 on. So the Seminole tribe never dropped the vaccination program. We always paid a vet, whether the federal was paying it or not. We vaccinated our calves for brucellosis. And when we started the brucellosis program here in the state of Florida, the Seminole herds were clean. Because somebody told us we should follow this practice. And so this federal agent, Fred Mastioka, he was the guy that worked for the federals and worked with the state, and he taught us how to become the cattle people that we are today. And plus, we had our natural own abilities. So today, in the 20th century, we started with the computer chip in the cattle ear. And like Miss Iris told me, says, y'all are lucky. said, y'all were the first one to do it, and it was free. You know? So we were experimenting with it, and but you know, there's markets out there. They will not buy cattle in the foreign market unless the cattle is ID'd and being able to find out. And I have a ID button in the ear here, and that's how we do it. It's a computer chip, and when they round up the herd, they can wand the cow and see how many calves she's had, what bulls were in the herd, and then they can wand the calf and collate the calf with the mama. And if there's a mad cow disease, they can correlate numbers, and it's all a tracking device, and what pasture she come from. So there's many uses for this button here, but like I said, it was under experimental, and the National Cattlemen's Association did not endorse it, so it's not mandatory. But I understand maybe in the next 5 years, all herds will have to have these IDs.
How ironic that you cut their ears and brand them, the most ancient form of identification, and then you also put the computer chip in their ear. It's kind of like a convergence of technologies, ancient
technology meets
and modern.
Ancient.
Right.
Bill, you have some questions for Norman?
Well, one of the things, Norman, when I had the good fortune to go on a roundup with the Brighton cattle crew, and they said Norman did a lot of the roping to catch the calves so they could mark their ears, and the calves do not submit to having their ears marked lightly. They're struggling and fighting the whole time. But Norman would go out and rope them and pull them up to the crew that was marking their ears. And I thought it would be really good to get him to tell us about roping here this morning. He was kind enough to bring a lasso with him. So Norman, why don't you, most people, or I won't say most people, but I assumed it was just a regular rope. And it's not. It's a lariat that's designed for roping. So it's got different parts to it. So why don't you tell us about the different parts of the rope there.
Yeah, on these ropes here, they're all different sizes. There's hard, medium, and soft. I always use soft so it's so limber when I rope calves. It go around their neck a lot easier. If it's stiff, the calf will go through it. So we just keep roping. So I always like to use soft, and right here is a medium. They don't want to hear me. Yeah, most of the time when I mark these calves for these people, you got to mammy the cow and calf up and grab the right calf, or there's two or three owners in one herd, and they always want me because I've been there all my life. I can mam them up easier and quicker, and just so simple. Like I tell everybody in the world, we didn't start yesterday.
So it's important to get the right calf with its mother. And so what do you look for to see when you're mammying them up?
Well, I check by their... the color on their face or feet, if they look like the mama, don't, because you get some calves sucking on the mama cow, and I know it ain't hers. So I just keep walking around till the other calf come back to the mama cow, and the mama cow know where her baby is all the time.
Well, is it exactly how they look or how they act around each other?
Well,
or
most
is it
times
a combination
how they
of the
look.
Two?
How they look. How they built, their body is framed. Most time they look just like their mama.
Okay, so you use the physical form of the calf to connect it with the mama.
Yes, sir.
And that's important in dividing the herds up when it's time for marketing.
Right.
Okay.
You can easily part them out that way. Like they call me dad all the time. Say, Dad, go ride these pairs out. Because there'd be four or five times people buy cows, calves from this man, and he wants four or five pairs. I'd ride in there, ride them out. And just so simple. And the guy says, you know how to do it, Dad.
Well, it's simple for you, but it might be complex for some of us less schooled people.
Right.
Okay, but so you mammy them up and get the right calf with the right cow, but then you like rope the calf to get it so you can mark it, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, I was just fascinated because, like, show them the loop on the
– It's according to how big the loop you want to carry all the time.
Well, here, I was thinking like that.
The Hondo?
Yeah.
They call it a Hondo, and they call this little burner. It's a regular hide. Hog hide, calf hide?
Yeah, it's buckskin or whatever you want.
It's plastic. On any road. Some boys put plastic on there, and it saves your rope for a long time.
Okay. It saves your rope, and it speeds your rope up.
Yeah, but I mean, you think it's just a loop, or at least I thought it was just a loop, but you can see it's got this little slider up here, the Hondo.
Yes, sir, Hondo.
And that makes it so it will move properly and also keeps from wearing out your loop. So that was something I never knew, and I was just pleased to learn about it. Now, you talked about the different lengths of the rope, too. What's explain that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I had one rope a while ago, 50 foot long. I like to use that in the woods. When you catch a bad bull or something got sharp horns, you can rope them and take off. But like these ropes I got in this hand today, it's real short. They hook your horse or knock off your horse or knock you down. That's why I always use a long rope when I'm roping them bad bulls, because them bulls will hurt you.
Okay, and I was going to say, if you could sort of demonstrate how you throw the lasso. You'll have to stand up and do this. I don't think you can do it seated.
By the way, we're going to have a roping contest for the public and people who really know how to do it and people who are just learning. And we have fabulous prizes. And that'll be at 4 o'clock. And Norman and Willie will be over at the other side of the tent where the roping dummy is.
He learned this from Will Rogers. Another famous Indian cowboy.
Is it pretty important to follow through with your right hand like you did? Notice a lot of people do that.
Oh, yeah.
Put that hand out.
Oh, it got away. Just like a field goal kicker picking up a blade of grass.
Well, and Norman makes it look so easy, but imagine him on the back of a horse that's charging down the field, throwing at a moving target. It takes a lot of skill and a lot of practice for that. Now, how old were you when you started roping, Norman? So since you've been walking, you've been roping.
Yeah. Always had a rope in my hand, riding horses. Living all my life.
There was a twist to your hand. You gotta keep it wide open.
We've been riding horses all our lives. We broke colts and we've kicked and stomped and roped and ate a lot of dust in our young days on the reservation. So,
well, perhaps you can tell us about the sort of yearly cycle with the cattle. I mean, like in the spring, you just if you could explain that to the folks.
Yeah, we the co-op, the Seminole Tribe, we put our bulls out seasonal, and like right now. At this time, our cows are having calves now. So we should be out in the pasture looking at our cows. But we're over here talking to you and telling you.
Yeah, that's right.
Checking the pasture and seeing how the calves are doing. But as it is. So come around January 1st, we'll put the bulls out with the cows. And they'll recycle and then... come around July, we will ship them out when the calves weigh from 350 to what, about 500?
600
pound calves. So we're also one of the first people to experiment with video sales. The Superior program you see on RFD. We were originally one of the original founders of that. Superior Livestock Sale. And we started off with telephone conference calls, and from there it grew into what it is today, video sales.
And, so you sell all your cattle by video?
We sell, well, the calves.
Yeah, that's what I meant, all the calves. No live.
Well, it's natural grasses that we pasture, improved hays like Bahia or Pangola,
smut grass,
palmetto roots, stone, you know, whatever. Some of us has a little bit of a. Right. Yes, we do alfalfa on our horses and such, you know, our performance horses. We have a lot of people. Sure. We have a lot of rodeo folks that are within the tribe, and they feed their performance horses alfalfa. But if you feed an old cow pony alfalfa, he'd either colic or he'd run away with you. He wouldn't know what hit him, you know. It's like hitting him with a B-12 or something.
Speaking of rodeo, tell us about your involvement in rodeo, and then we'll get Norman to do the same.
Well, like I said, I grew up wanting to be a cowboy, so I followed the rodeo trail and rode broncs. You saw this young man demonstrating bronc riding. I did that, bareback riding, bulls. And now in my later age, I had to say goodbye to it, regrettably, but because I enjoyed it. I loved the rodeo life. I loved the road, the camaraderie. I love the free spirit. I guess it's because of my nativeness. I don't know, but I still participate. I'm a commissioner of the Indian National Finals Rodeo, which is held in Globe, Arizona every year. And so I've been there about 15 years now. And so I see cowboys coming and going year in and year out. And so right now in my heyday of rodeo, I just participate in team roping. It's the last straw. Unless I go to barrel racing.
Nah, we didn't want to run too fast for barrels.
Well, Norman, you've participated in rodeo and too, so why don't you give us a little brief history of your rodeo operation, your rodeo activities.
Yeah, I team rope. Am I close enough? Yeah, I team roped my partners, and I break away. And I won it last year, and they're 50 and older. There are probably about 8 of us have been roping all year, and I lucked up, won it last year, the 50 and older breakaway. And I got daughters and 2 daughters. They go with the Indian National Final of Rodeos. They go. I follow them all over the world.
Well, now, a lot of people don't know what team roping is, so could you explain that for us?
Yeah, team roping, you have had a header and a healer. And you run that steer right in the middle of the arena, rope him, and stretch him out.
Well, now, I was always, when Norman started talking about a healer, somehow I thought he meant veterinarian. But what it is the healer puts a rope around the heels, the hind legs of the targeted cow. And the header is not a typing phrase, but puts the rope around the head. So you have to catch it on the head and the feet. And that's not as easy as you might think.
Nope, we had a little rodeo the other day. I'm still chasing that steer. I ain't caught him yet.
Well, now, does team roping have a practical application in ranching?
Yeah, about the same, because they catch some bad bulls in the pasture or in the woods or middle of a hammock, you got to have another guy with you all the time. If you don't, them bulls will hurt you.
So sometimes animals just so cantankerous you have to put ropes on both ends to hold it down.
Yes, sir. Most time they will knock you down.
Well, now, is your specialty heading or heeling when it comes to roping?
Well, in the woods, I like roping around the head in the woods. Because if I can hurt him, I can choke him down. Because he will hurt you or hurt your horse.
Yeah, I mean, cowboying is a very romantic occupation, but it can be dangerous because you've got, how much does a horse weigh?
Horses we ride, they probably weigh between 1,000 and 1,200 pounds.
And what about a yearling? How much do you expect a yearling would weigh?
Yearling horse or?
Or a cow.
Around about 7 or 8.
So that's like a 1,000-pound animal that could fall on top of you, or about an 800-pound animal that could fall on top of you. So it's a hazardous occupation, but you obviously love the work. What is it about it you like so much?
I don't know. I guess I've done it all my life. Get up 5 o'clock in the morning, saddle your horse, and go before the sun comes up. I guess you got to love it. It's like going to work.
Well, if it's like going to work, you might be. But, I mean, really, can you think about what is it that appeals to you about it? You've been doing it so long, it's probably hard to think about, but what's your favorite part of it?
Getting up, I guess, because you never know if you're going to get up or not. I have cowboys. I got to wait all day long. I get tired of waiting on them. I just go on.
Well, I'll have to say that when I went on the roundup with Norman, he kept looking at me saying, "Are you having fun yet?" And I had fun the whole time because you're out there on the back of a horse riding through the countryside, and it's just an exhilarating experience.
You know, a lot of them horses that we rode probably didn't weigh 1,000 pounds, and we used to rope, 1,200-pound bulls and steers off of them. So we had to depend on our buddy over there, you know, that as soon as you got your rope on that bull and you're riding an 800-pound colt, he never had a bull tied to him, so he's real proud of you, you know, for doing that to him. So you need your friend to come in there and also catch so we can drag him out of the hammock or load him on a trailer. So it's just the way of life that we were brought up, you know. That's what we wanted to do, you know. Our folks own cattle, and we wanted to own cattle, and we own cattle, and so it's just, I guess I didn't want to allude back to that word, but it's tradition. Yeah. They're smarter than we are. They're getting education, and it's hard work, you know. It's hard to get up early in the morning, you know.
Well, our time is running down. Do we have any more questions? Okay.
Yeah, I might have missed this earlier. I apologize if you've done this. You've heard a lot about the cow whip and the techniques of the cow dog, and I didn't hear y'all talk about that. Are those part of the ranching traditions or not? Have they gone by the way, or were they originally there to begin with?
Yeah, they did. We had original cow whip makers. We had one that, when we were growing up, Eli Morgan used to make cow whips, and he tanned his own hides. And before the Spanish made the cattle herd so important, the cow whip with the Creek people or the Muscogee people in the Southeast were used as weapons. They would have, actually, if you run out of arrows and in a fight, you would just break out your whip and go at each other's till one run or whoever stood the test. So it had just kind of progressed through the cattle, you know, and cows got used to it and hearing it crack. Even the pioneers, they used it for like a telephone. You know, they could go to a holler of a swamp and pop their whip, and one meant it's a girl, two is a boy, or 5 or 6 is grandpa just died, you know. Or that's how the early Floridians communicated with the cow whip. So it's important where and when you cracked it. So yeah, we use. Sure. So you're talking about the dog? Yeah, we we've been using cur dogs for years and years, and matter of fact, Norman's got a house full of them.
We're going to have our time's running out. We're going to have a cow dog narrative stage. We have four dogs up here talking. No, we're going to have three or four folks up here talking about using cow dogs, so we'll get into that a little further. We need to get the Cowboy Artists Association of Florida up here. But thanks a lot, Mr. Willie Johns and Mr. Norman Johns. We're right over here, so. Check out their display. They have a beautiful display, and we have a roping contest. I think it's 4 o'clock over there with fabulous prizes. You won't believe these prizes.
Bring your best loot.